there's a certain comedy in hearing yourself praised. And Tim, that just matters immensely to me. Your great kindness. And I'm somewhat embarrassed to have nothing to present to follow it with, but just me. The great problem about being a writer is that you can represent yourself as better than you are. Well, I took this seriously as I could before I got here, and I wrote a speech, but I'm going to have to begin it by departing from it and confessing that I'm not prepared. I've found this out over and over again. You can't be prepared. I thought it was remarkable that I got this invitation, this news from an organization devoted to peace. That surprised me. But that didn't prepare me for the reality of this occasion in which I've been allowed to associate with my colleagues who have been honored here, and the wonderful people who've organized this program, and the wonderful people who are attending. It's a little hard to take in. Tim and I were asking a little rhetorically and maybe a little sarcastically while ago, where's the Peace Academy? Where is the Peace Academy? And I didn't think until afterwards, well, sitting in the midst of this amazing crowd, a crowd like this from one place turn out for a meeting under the heading of peace. I thought, maybe the Peace Academy is right here. Maybe this is it. You don't have a football team yet, but that'll come. When we were notified of this award, my wife, Tanya Berry, uttered a sound that closely resembled laughter, which it probably was. She, better than anybody, knows how willingly I have risked controversy and how much I've enjoyed it, especially when I was young. In my favor, I can only say that I've never killed or physically harmed any of my enemies or wish to do so, and that I don't carry a pistol. The only thing I would really enjoy shooting is a drone. I am, of course, grateful for this award and all that it means. And I am, of course, necessarily humbled and somewhat troubled by it. There's something a little odd, after all, in giving an award associated with peace to any member of an industrial society. For the industrial economy, from agriculture to war, is by far the most violent the world has ever known, and we are all complicit in its violence. The history of industrialization has been violent from the start, as the Luddites quickly learned. The purpose of labor-saving technology has always been to cheapen work by displacing workers, thus increasing the flow of wealth from the less wealthy to the more wealthy. It is a fact, one we have never adequately acknowledged or understood, that at the end of World War II, industry geared up to to adapt the mechanical and chemical technologies of war to agriculture and other ways of using land. At the same time, certain corporate and academic leaders, known collectively as the Committee for Economic Development, decided that there were too many farmers. The relatively self-sufficient producers on small farms needed to become members of the industrial labor force and consumers of industrial commodities. Reducing the number of farmers and farms became a devastatingly effective national policy. The first problem of a drastic reduction of the land-using population is to keep the land producing in the absence of the people. The Committee for Economic Development and their allies were fully aware of this problem, and they had a ready solution. The absent people would be replaced by the mechanical and chemical technologies developed for military use and subsisting upon a seemingly limitless bounty of natural resources, mainly ores and fuels. Agriculture would become an industry. Farms would become factories like other factories, ever more automated and remotely controlled. Industrial land use became a front in a war against the living world. And so, with a few exceptions, the free market was allowed to have its way. Finally, nearly all of the land-using population have left their family farms and their home places and moved or commuted into the cities to be industrially or professionally employed or unemployed, and to be entirely dependent upon the ways and the products of industrialism. This process of eliminating the too many farmers still continues. Nobody ever said how many were too many. Nobody ever said how many might actually be necessary. Even so, to remove the farmers from farming required a shift of interest from husbanding the fertility of the land to burning the fossil fuels, with consequences so far less famous than terrifying. But there was another problem that the population engineers did not recognize then and have not recognized yet. Agricultural production without land maintenance leads to exhaustion. Land that is in use, if the use is to continue, must be used with care. And care is not and can never be an industrial product or an industrial result. Care can come only from what we used to understand as the human heart, so called because it is central to human being. The human heart is informed by the history of care and the need for care, also by the heritage of the skills of caring and of caretaking. The replacement of our displaced rural families by technologies derived from warfare has involved inevitably a supposedly acceptable and generally accepted violence against land and people. By it, we established an analogy between land use and war that has remained remarkably consistent ever since. The common theme is a terrible pragmatism that grants an automatic predominance of the end over the means. The sacrifice of land and people to the objective of victory, domination, security, or profit, in oblivion or defiance of any moral or natural law that may stand in the way. All of our prevalent forms of land use, which is to say land use minus care, produces, in addition to commercial products, massive waste and destruction. War is politics minus neighborly love plus technological progress, which makes it ever more massively wasteful and destructive. There is, in fact, no significant difference of means between mass destruction and massive destruction. In order to mine a seam of coal in eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, we destroy a mountain, its topsoil, and its forest, with no regard for the ecosystem or for the people, downhill, downstream, and later in time. The difference between explosion in the coal fields and erosion in the corn and soybean fields is only that erosion is slower. The end, the exhaustion of nature's life-supporting systems, is the same. But this should not surprise us if we have understood at all the history of industrial war. In his ironically titled book, Freedom from Fear, David M. Kennedy wrote that by August 1945, the atomic bombs hardly represented a moral novelty. The moral rules that had once stayed men's hands from taking up weapons of mass destruction against non-combatants had long since been violently breached in World War II. First in the aerial attacks on European cities, then even more wantonly in the systematic firebombing of Japan. He might have added other instances of such destruction in that war by our enemies, our allies, and ourselves. Beyond the scope of Professor Kennedy's book, the instances of this disregard go on and on, always elaborately justified as national righteousness and the defense of freedom. In the accounting of our wars, we speak often of the human cost to our side, the lives of young people spent, as we say, in defense of our way of life. We speak little of the human costs and collateral damages paid by our enemies. We speak almost never of the ecological costs of industrial war, which we must assume to be as great, as unsustainable, as the ecological costs of industrial land use. But surely, by now, the official rationalizations of our violence have become too obviously hypocritical to be ignored. Violence against our world and our fellow beings finally cannot be dissociated from the violence of untruth. How can we continue to insist that our land-destroying, water- and air-polluting agriculture is the only way to feed the world, especially now since we have devoted so much of it to biofuels to feed our automobiles? How can we assume that the world can be fed by an agriculture that continues to assign the greatest risks, the lowest income, and no regard at all to the producers? Why should we think that high rates of production can be maintained when the land is increasingly degraded and ever fewer farmers' children want to farm? Moreover, why should we continue to believe that our government is uniquely to be trusted with our weapons of mass destruction, whereas other nations are not to be trusted with them? What does trustworthiness mean in relation to the possession of weapons of mass destruction? Why is the cost of our wars now paid almost exclusively by the young people in the armed services who must pay with their bodies and their lives. Why do our patriotic citizens and their representatives not insist upon the tax increases necessary to support our wars? Why do they not ration or otherwise curtail our overuse of fuels and materials necessary to our wars? Such questions, no doubt, are merely naive. Surely prevarication, bad faith, self-serving, and nonsense must be normally and expectably among the costs of representative government. Surely, despite such frailties, but assisted by the will of God and his prejudice in our favor, our rights will be preserved and our freedoms will endure. We speak of freedom, of our God-given freedom, of defending, using, and destroying freedom, as of something memorized in grade school and never thought of again. We might as well be talking in our sleep. We have been so thoughtless and careless of our freedom for so long that by now we cannot see that our assumed right to be limitlessly violent would finally bring us to violence against freedom that may destroy it and that will be extremely difficult to oppose. I am speaking of our present massive effort of so-called national security, comprised of an immense force of secret police, regulated by processes and persons equally secret, and possessing a gigantic technology of surveillance, also secret, which it has used to intrude into the private communications of every citizen of our own country and evidently every citizen in the world who has the misfortune of a computer or a telephone. And all of this with no hint of probable cause and without a sham or shadow of due process. A people inured to violence, even as entertainment, may have difficulty in seeing such an unassertive, so far, enterprise of security as violent. After all, we would not yet even have heard of it had not an alleged criminal, by an exemplary act of citizenship, apprised us of its existence. But of course it is violent. Under our system of government, it is violent in its conception and purpose. It violates the Fourth Amendment's guarantee of the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. It violates our most intimate and natural sense of personal privacy that is the source and justification of the Fourth Amendment. It is a flagrant insult legally to our Constitution and personally to ourselves. It is a blatant assertion of absolute and unquestionable power, exactly the totality of government that we have claimed to be opposing in all the wars of my lifetime, and of course every imaginable violence is potential in it. Almost as dismaying as this secretive and tyrannous security is the talk among people reputedly intelligent of the need to balance freedom and security. Balance is an unfortunate word here, for it raises two extremely perilous questions. Who is to load the scales? And who is to position the fulcrum? In our customary glibness about freedom, are we now supposing that it is a substantial commodity, some of which can be portioned off and exchanged for another commodity called security. But there can be no balance between freedom and secret police, freedom and universal suspicion, freedom and tyranny. There is only choice. If we have the courage, we will choose freedom. And we will use it to oppose our government's frivolous and dangerous secrecy, which it imposes upon us under the claim of security, but really to hide its abuse of power and its shame. Peace comes from freedom, real freedom. It comes from responsibility, real acceptance of responsibility. Freedom is not simple, for it always is involved with responsibility. The relation between freedom and responsibility is not a balance to be expediently adjusted by governments or citizens who, without both, can have neither. I've quoted John Milton's definition of freedom before, and I'm going to quote it again, for it is complex and precise enough to have the force of an essential justice. To be free, Milton wrote, is precisely the same thing as to be pious, wise, just, and temperate, careful of one's own, abstinent from what is another's, and thence, in fine, magnanimous and brave.